You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the chairman of the Wisconsin Conservation Congress about the record-setting responses to this year's spring hearings questionnaire. First, the U.S. Department of Agriculture released details this week about $19 billion of farm support that was part of the Phase 3 coronavirus stimulus bill passed in late March. Applications for that money will start being processed on May 26th. Also, yesterday, Governor Tony Evers announced that he'll be directing $50 million in federal funding to support the state's farming industry. The aid packages come as the demand for certain agricultural goods has dropped, with restaurants, schools, and some food processors being closed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. For many Wisconsin farmers, it's yet another financial challenge after years of low dairy prices and an ongoing trade dispute with China. Andrew Stevens is an assistant professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Can you talk about what Wisconsin farmers have been hit by the pandemic so far?
Sure. So the COVID-19 pandemic has really shocked the food supply chain and consumer demand for a lot of different food goods. So specifically for meat producers and dairy producers, you've seen all of these usual places for those products to go really disappear pretty quickly. Schools are closed. Meat packing plants are closing sort of off and on. And so there's this overabundance of supply, nowhere for it to go. And so you're seeing prices really take a tumble. And sometimes animals are even being culled because there's no place for them to go.
It seems weird on the face of it because we're all still eating in theory, but these are two completely different supply chains in some cases, right?
Yeah, so what's really interesting is that this pandemic has changed drastically where Americans are eating and what they're eating. So before this all happened, roughly more than half of all of the food expenditures that we made as food consumers were for food away from home. So now that we're all staying at home and going to the grocery store to primarily get the food we're eating, that's really shifted where we're eating and consequently, the kind of foods that we're eating at the same time.
Let's key in on dairy for a moment. Before the pandemic, we'd had long stretches of low milk prices, concerns about international trade disputes causing problems for farmers. Were things looking better for 2020 pre-pandemic at all?
They were not looking this bad. I would say the forecasts that we had sort of over the winter here were that things seemed to be creeping better, maybe not sort of a full bounce back to boom times of the past, but people were cautiously optimistic. I think a lot of those hopes have sort of been dashed by the current shock.
Here we are now with farm aid from the USDA directly and then from the state using federal money coming down another pipe in effect. Do we know what the most effective ways of supplying this kind of emergency relief to farmers are?
When you're talking about this much money, and we're talking about roughly $19 billion from the federal government and then $50 million from the state government, it's a complicated program to administer. So we knew that this money was coming from the federal government about a month ago. And what we found out this week was exactly what that's going to look like, who's going to receive it, how payments are going to be calculated. That's all going to be handled through the Farm Service Agency over the next couple of months and throughout the rest of this year. And I predict there's going to be a lot of bureaucratic work for the government, and people will receive some support if they apply and are eligible, but there might be plenty of hoops to jump through to get that all sorted out.
There are concerns when we do something like this, and this was true with the trade war relief that went to farmers, concerns about fairness. Are the big operations getting more than their due? Are smaller farmers being left out or not getting enough help? What do we know about this particular package and how it's going to be divided out?
Yeah, so the way that the package is written right now is that individual producers' payments under this program, the federal program, would be capped at $125,000 per commodity with an overall limit of $250,000 per individual or entity. So that'd be like $250,000 per farm would be a maximum. Now, there are some exceptions, and if you're a farm that's organized as a corporate entity like an LLC, that maximum could go up to as much as $750,000. But in some sense, that's there to make sure that these really large farms aren't getting sort of the lion's share of the pie. But the flip side is, you know, all of these producers are hurting. Even big producers, you know, have people to pay on their payroll. So I think the government is trying to, as best they can, thread this needle and provide relief to everyone that's feeling the crunch.
We're talking to Andrew Stevens, Assistant Professor of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison, about federal relief efforts for farmers hit hard by the economic downturn with the COVID-19 outbreak. Andrew, the amounts we're talking about here, $19 billion at the federal level plus $50 million here in Wisconsin via the state, are these amounts that are going to make a difference, that are going to help keep operations in business until things get back to something like normal?
That's the hope, at least, right? So I would characterize this program, this is a Band-Aid. This is a first aid suture to try and deal with what is blunt force trauma to the agricultural sector because of the pandemic. This is not sort of a new long-term sustainable farm support program. It's really designed to address the fact that for a lot of food products, both crops and livestock, we've seen pretty significant price drops over the last 3 months. So just to give you a sense, between the beginning of 2020 and now, we've seen futures prices fall between 13% for soybeans all the way up to 50% for hogs. And so a lot of the justification for this support program is to address that really sharp drop in prices. It's not so much to do anything about the fundamentals of these individual farms. It's more to acknowledge the fact that people have faced a really quick moving shock, faced really, really low prices recently, and to compensate for that to some extent. I think the objective that the government has is certainly not to compensate completely for all of the lost revenue because of these low prices, but to try and take the worst of the bite off of this shock that we've gotten through the pandemic.
I've seen there are some creative sounding efforts to splice the supply chain a little bit to pay farmers who might have been counting on supplying the restaurant industry to take some of their produce and have it go to food boxes for to help meet the demand for food from people who are unemployed now. Is that something that can be done in enough of a scale that is actually going to help farmers in the meantime?
Well, so of this $19 billion coming from the federal government, $3 billion of it is for direct purchases of food goods from farmers to donate to food shelves or to do, sort of farmers boxes, as the federal government has talked about. There is some sense in which this is helpful, but that's not the lion's share of what's going on here. About $16 billion are going to these direct payments to producers because of these price decreases. I do think the government is not terribly efficient at finding the right connections between producers and consumers. To be honest, no one's really good at that. That's why sort of the market system that we have is designed to let prices communicate scarcity and help people who want things sort of find what's in abundance and what they can afford. And that's how we allocate food generally. I think what you're seeing with all of these efforts to try and pair producers with consumers is coming from the right place of trying to acknowledge the fact that we have a lot of food, we have a lot of people who would like to eat the food, and trying to make those connections. But it is difficult in between. Supply chains are complicated. Refrigeration is a really important component of fresh produce and meat products and dairy. And so it's not as simple as snapping our fingers and making this all make sense.
I also wanted to touch on this $50 million program here in Wisconsin. This is using some of the sort of at-will federal money that went to states. This $50 million applications, I think, starting soon with the Department of Revenue. Payments could start in early June. Do you know much about how that works?
You know about as much as I do. Basically, what we've got is the governor's press release on this, and I think we're all looking to see when the details will be shared so that we can give better advice to producers.
Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Andrew Stevens is an assistant professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. He talked to us about coronavirus aid available to farmers, $50 million through the state government, $19 billion being given out nationwide by the USDA. Coming up, respondents to the Wisconsin Conservation Congress spring hearings overwhelmingly rejected the idea of extending the deer hunting season. We'll get into that and more of the questionnaire results coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Wisconsin Elections Commission delayed a final vote on a plan to send absentee ballot applications to millions of voters. Coming up, we'll look at the arguments for and against a vote-at-home system and whether it could be implemented for the fall elections. First, every spring, the Wisconsin Conservation Congress holds spring hearings in each of the state's counties asking citizens for input on a variety of topics. They take those responses into account when advising the Natural Resources Board on possible policy changes for the DNR. This is the first year the spring hearings took place entirely virtually because of the coronavirus pandemic, and there was a big response. Larry Bondi is chair of the Wisconsin Conservation Congress. Larry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having us on.
Before, Larry, we dig into the results, you know, some people live and breathe Conservation Congress. Other people in the state might not be as familiar with it. Can you tell us what it is and what you do?
It's something really unique. We're the only state in the nation where you have a citizen advisory body, and we're recognized in statute as an advisory capacity to the Natural Resources Board, which sets policy for the Department of Natural Resources. It really gives the average citizen incredible input on resource management, and we're very lucky to have something so special in Wisconsin.
And what's the role of these spring hearings?
The spring hearing is to take, and this year was simply advisory questions, but on some years there are rule change proposals. There were three different sets of questions. There were some questions proposed by the Department of Natural Resources that were advisory. There were a handful of advisory questions by the Natural Resources Board, and then there were a handful of questions, about 30 questions, from Wisconsin Conservation Congress that were advisory questions that came from citizens' resolutions that were brought to our spring hearings in a particular county last year, and then this year they come as we review those and they come back as advisory questions, the ones that cut the mustard, so to say.
And again, before we get to the questions themselves, let's get into the how. Usually you do most of this in person, I believe. What was it like to scramble and make sure you could do this all virtually?
Well, I never would have thought last year, when we was the first year that we ever implemented any type of online input option, that we, a year later, we'd be in a situation where we couldn't have any type of live in-person responses simply because of the pandemic issue. So I think that we got extremely lucky that the Congress had the foresight to try something very new last year. Typically, we get, you know, anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 responses in person. Last year, with the first year with the online, we had about 8,000 online responses. This year, we had a record of 65,000 online responses that gave us input on the variety of advisory questions we have. The only time we've ever had anything even remotely close was a year when they proposed the dove hunting season we have in Wisconsin. And at that time, we had over 30,000 people show up. So we doubled our previous record.
Wow. I remember those days. You could guarantee the phones ringing off the hook when we talked about that here on the Ideas Network. Well, let's get into some of the headline issues that were on the surveys this year, Larry. And one big one was the idea of extending gun deer season. Can you talk about what proposals were out there?
So there were several proposals. There was one from the Natural Resources Board that would actually make a 19-day firearm season starting the same day that we currently started, the Saturday before Thanksgiving. And the reason I believe the Natural Resources Board chose that is because they can only deal with rules, and currently it's in statute when we open our deer season. However, the Congress did propose a different question that would move the season up to around the 15th of November, and very similar to what Michigan has, and propose a 15-day firearm season there. Interesting enough that, you know, I've been in this game with the Congress for just about 30 years, and I've seen questions like this, extending our firearm season or creating something similar to Michigan where we start early. And Wisconsin has always been a bit of traditionalist when it comes to our deer hunters. Deer hunting creates incredible passion, incredible participation. And so I wasn't really overly surprised that the results mirrored attempts in the past to extend the firearm season, and they failed.
And pretty substantially, if I read it right.
Yes, yes.
Now, one of the arguments, Larry, for extending the season, I think, was that we're not seeing the participation, not seeing people pick up the tradition of hunting the way they used to. This might give people more opportunities. Is that that fundamental topic? Are we seeing enough people getting into hunting? Is that something that Conservation Congress members are worried about?
Clearly, Wisconsin is no different than any other state. Every state in the nation has seen a decline in hunting participation. And, you know, luckily, Wisconsin, we're not losing hunters quite as fast as other states, but there's no doubt that we're very concerned about this. So every time we look at these proposals, we try to listen to what people are telling us. And, you know, last year and in 2019, we had a rather poor results from our deer hunting season. We didn't have the harvest that everybody expected. However, the way the calendar works, it was one of the latest openers that we could possibly have, and the deer were pretty much wrapping up their rut activity, which is when they're the most active, and the harvest was down. And I think that there was a lot of anxiety and angst from people that, you know, how are we going to continue to get people be interested in our activities if they don't harvest and they don't see deer? So I think it was an honest attempt to try to get some consensus on how we should recruit and retain some of our hunters.
Talking to Larry Bondi, chair of the Wisconsin Conservation Congress, looking at their spring survey, all online this year, a lot of response to it. Let's get into some of the other issues that came up here. There were a lot of things, the idea of a no hunting period before the start of gun season, things are related to crossbow hunting of deer. Anything stand out to you from some of those different topics?
You know, the crossbow issue was something that came to Wisconsin only a handful of years ago. And when the legislature instituted a crossbow season, they made it a separate season from the vertical bow for the whole purpose that there was a lot of concern that the crossbows would fire a more effective weapon and people are going to be harvesting a lot more deer. Hence, there could be fewer deer in the landscape by the time the firearm season starts, especially bucks. Every hunter wants a buck. We have more than enough antlerless in the state. But the big prize is to harvest a deer with antlers, a buck. And so there was the Natural Resources Board chose to throw that question out there if we wanted to alter our season, shorten some of the crossbow season, and make it more equitable, so to say. They were looking at different number statistics of who is harvesting numbers at what rate. And again, they put those out for public opinion. And much to my surprise, actually, people are okay with the status quo, and they don't really want to alter their our newfound crossbow season.
Lurking behind some of the ideas that were rejected by Conservation Congress members, extending the deer season, the gun deer season, concerns about baiting and feeding of deer, earn a buck, I think they thought about bringing that back. That was rejected. Concerns about chronic wasting disease and trying to stop its spread among the Wisconsin deer herd. Are there chronic wasting disease efforts that you see Conservation Congress members getting behind?
Yeah, the Conservation Congress is very supportive of CWD efforts to somehow curtail the spread and try to do whatever we can to keep it contained as much as possible. When we bring questions to the public, and I think when the Natural Resources Board asked a question about the baiting and feeding issue, everybody knows that concentrating animals through artificial bait and feed is not good for other health issues, even beyond CWD, like tuberculosis and other issues. And so they put the question out about baiting and feeding, and yet what really surprised me is the people that responded that gave us input, they're still supporting a practice that we know is not very good in a disease situation. So it is sort of interesting that people claim there is the concern, and yet when we put these questions out to the public, they want to continue a practice that we know isn't really the right thing for the health of our deer herd.
I want to get back to the issue of, bringing a new generation of hunters in. And I know organizations and I think the DNR have had programs over the years. Is this something the Conservation Congress is looking at? How do we introduce this to maybe people who grew up with hunting and got away with it, or bringing in people who didn't grow up with it and getting into it now?
Yeah, there's no doubt the Congress has been working very hard and in partnership with the Department of Natural Resources to try to recruit and retain our hunters. You know, what we always forget is things are constantly changing. We all long for the past, and there's no doubt that we need our sportsmen because currently they're the main funders of conservation in this state. And without the dollars that they spend, who's going to fund conservation? And we also need the sporting community to continue to manage the burgeoning deer populations and other animal populations that we have in the state. So it's very important, and we have been working on that. Nobody's found the silver bullet. We see certain glimmers of hope, but we also know that there's demands on people's time in society now that they're sort of unprecedented. People work different hours, longer hours. There's a lot of different activities for youth and parents to partake in outside of the old traditional hunting and fishing and trapping consumptive sports. And we also have a lot less people living in rural settings where that was sort of a subsistence issue where we lived off the land to a certain extent. We got our licenses and we made sure we had fishing game in the freezer for food. And that's not quite as important as it was in the past. And somehow we got to turn that dial and find the people who we know people love the outdoors. We just got to get them connected to our consumptive sports.
As we wrap up, Larry, if there are people who think of themselves as sporting types but who haven't got involved with the Conservation Congress, how do they do that?
If you go to the DNR and you click Conservation Congress, it's actually on their main menu page. We have our own website within the Department of Natural Resources website, and you can search everything that we have on our website, and including how to become a member. And if you're not an adult and you have some interest, there's also something called the Youth Conservation Congress, which is sort of our recruiting tool to get people who are younger that have conservation interests involved in our process.
Larry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you very much for allowing me some time.
That's Larry Bondi, chair of the Wisconsin Conservation Congress. We talked to him today about the overwhelming response to the Congress's first ever digital-only spring hearings questionnaire. Coming up, we'll look at the pros and cons of voting at home and whether Wisconsin might be the next state to give it a try. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on the morning show, find out how Wisconsin's craft beer producers are doing in the midst of the pandemic. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, voting by mail could be a big part of Wisconsin's fall elections. The State Elections Commission is looking at a plan that would substantially increase the number of absentee ballots. It would be paid for with federal COVID-19 relief money. The panel delayed a final vote yesterday after the Republican chair said he wanted to send those forms to fewer people. It could meet again next week. A record 62% of residents voted absentee in the April election during the early stages of Wisconsin's stay-at-home order. Turnout for the November presidential election is expected to be much higher. David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He's also editor-in-chief of the Election Law Journal and is affiliated with the Elections Research Center. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, what's on the table for the State Elections Commission when it could lead that could lead to more mail-in voting here in the state?
Well, one thing that they were had on the table yesterday was the idea to send the forms to request an absentee ballot to all registered voters in the state. That's something we've seen several states around the country do recently. Michigan, Nevada was in the news yesterday when President Trump was calling them out for doing this and saying this was voter fraud. So this issue has become really politicized just in the last couple of weeks where, in previous elections, voting by mail, there was strong bipartisan consensus that this was a good and reasonable way for people to vote when they, you know, couldn't make it to the polls on election day. But now, especially because President Trump has put this kind of front and center as a partisan issue, there was some pushback on the Wisconsin Election Commission yesterday from the two Republican appointees on the panel who resisted that idea of sending the reforms to request absentee ballots to all registered voters.
Let's give a listen to Dean Knutson, former state representative and Republican Elections Commission chair, talking about why he's not opposed to sending out these absentee ballot requests, but saying we don't need to do as many as they were looking at. Here's a listen.
You know, voters that already have a photo ID on file, I mean, they voted absentee before, they know how to do it. I don't see why we need to spend money to send them a paper request for something they've done before.
And then Republicans on the commission also pointed out that some local governments are already sending out applications for absentee ballots to a lot of people, so don't duplicate it. So are we just kind of tinkering around the edges of exactly how many people we send these applications to?
Right. I think, yes. I think eventually we will have a pretty massive effort to make sure that people do have the opportunity to vote by mail in Wisconsin. It's not like we're like Texas or some states where they are really trying to discourage vote by mail completely. And so it is more at the margins. So I think the number I read that the Democratic people on the commission were proposing something around 2.7 million. Republicans were shooting for something maybe closer to 2 million. So, you know, it's up for negotiation now in terms of exactly how many will be sent out and to who. So, like, if you already have a voter ID on file, as we just heard in the clip, I think that was about 500,000 people that are in that category. So that would reduce the number by quite a bit if they decided to go that direction.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've always been confused between the definitions of mail-in ballot versus absentee ballot. And I did talk to my representative, and what they told me was the difference is on an absentee ballot, a voter has to specifically call or go to the clerk, potentially show their ID, and then the ballot would be mailed to them. They can mail it back. Whereas in mail-in voting, the clerk just automatically sends the ballot regardless of whether or not the potential voter asked for it or not. Is that the difference?
Steve, thanks for the
no.
call and for pulling us back to a basic question. David, go ahead.
No, actually, no, that's not – we don't have – a system at all where it's automatically sent. There are only five states in the country that have that right now, and they're all states out west. So it's Washington, Oregon, and Colorado, Nevada, and Utah. But there are five states that have that automatic. We don't have that in Wisconsin. And so you have to request an absentee ballot in order to be able to vote by mail. Now, the part that's a little confusing is that you can have an absentee ballot that actually is not sent through the mail, but you can vote in person absentee, and that's normally what we would call early voting, where you go down to your clerk's office, or here in Madison, you can go to the library and vote in the library. And we have those early voting sites. That's considered an absentee vote because you're not voting on election day. So the general category is an absentee vote. That's when you're voting on some day other than election day. And that can either be in person at your clerk's office or at a polling site, early voting site, or by mail. But when you're voting by mail, you have to, in Wisconsin, request that ballot. It will not be automatically sent to you under any circumstances.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to David Cannon, political scientist at UW-Madison, looking at absentee voting and mail-in voting. A lot of states talking about expanding it around the country, including possibly Wisconsin sending applications for absentee ballots to more people. You mentioned President Trump. He's been critical of expansion of mail-in voting. Yesterday, he had threatened to withhold federal grants to Michigan and Nevada if those states sent absentee ballots or applications for them, I should say, to voters. Before heading out to Michigan today, he was asked about his opposition. Here's a listen.
We don't want them to do mail-in ballots because it's going to lead to total election fraud. So we don't want them to do mail-in ballots. We don't want anyone to do mail-in ballots. Now, if somebody has to mail it in because they're sick or, by the way, because they live in the White House, and they have to vote in Florida, and they won't be in Florida. If there's a reason for it, that's okay. If there's a reason. But if there's not, we don't want to take any chances with fraud in our elections.
So does more mail-in voting lead to more likelihood of fraud?
No, it doesn't. And so just another sort of category here that the president just talked about is the no-excuse absentee voting, which we have in Wisconsin, versus the excuse absentee voting, where you have to have an excuse. You're going to be out of the state, you work in the White House, and you live in Florida. And so President Trump, has voted by mail himself, as he just indicated. So 2/3 of the states in the United States right now have no excuse absentee voting. So what President Trump just said, it would be to undo the process of voting that we've used in 2/3 of the states in the United States for the last many decades. So this is not something that is just being invented because of the COVID pandemic. This is something that's been a routine part of voting, with hundreds of millions of ballots cast through this process in over the, again, last many decades. And so that's one thing that listeners should be aware of, is this is not something brand new that's just being proposed for the first time. Hundreds of millions of Americans have voted by mail for a long time. The second thing on fraud, this is something that has been debunked for so long by so many studies that there is just infinitesimally small risk of voter fraud from either just regular voting at the polling place or by mail. There was one study done, a big meta study by Rick Hazen, who's probably the top election expert in the country, and he did a sort of canvas of all the studies on voter fraud in American elections, and he discovered that out of all the elections from 2000 to 2012, we're talking about billions of votes being cast, there are 491 prosecutions related to absentee ballots in all elections from 2000 to 2012. And this, again, we're talking about billions of votes with a B, and there were 491 prosecutions because of absentee ballots. So this is not a problem. This is not something we should be worried about. What we should be worried about is allowing people to vote in a safe way during a pandemic so they don't have to make a choice between their own health and voting in an election.
We're talking about voting from home as a way to protect voters and poll workers from the coronavirus. David Cannon is our guest, professor of political science at UW-Madison, editor-in-chief of the Election Law Journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Wisconsin make it easier for people to vote from home? Should the state be sending out absentee voter applications, absentee ballot applications to everyone, many people? Did you get one in the mail from your local government in the last election? Do you like to vote by mail? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're looking at the possibility of Wisconsin expanding its mail-in voting efforts for fall elections. David Cannon is with us, political science professor at UW-Madison and editor-in-chief of the Election Law Journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on mail-in voting, making absentee ballots accessible to more people, to everyone. Should we try to go mail-in only in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hello.
Hello. My question would be, how do you expect the Postal Service to handle this when they struggle with letters at this stage of the game? Now mail gets lost, misplaced, sits around in post offices. How would you expect them to handle this situation, simply going all mail voting?
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Well, that's not a hypothetical. Even without all mail voting, there were concerns about ballots sitting in post offices. David, do we have the mail-in infrastructure for a huge jump potentially in absentee voting?
Well, it is a very good question. And we did see the reports of some of those ballots that were never delivered, that were actually, you know, sitting in these boxes in the post office. The Election Commission just had their final report they issued a couple days ago about absentee voting in the April primary. And they found that there were 2,659 ballots that were received after April 13th. So these were, you know, ballots that were mailed by Election Day, should have been in time, but still weren't delivered 6 days later. And because of the Supreme Court decision that set that April 13th deadline, those ballots ended up not, you know, being counted then. But there were 70,000 ballots that were counted in that intervening 6 days from Election Day until the 13th. But the mail, the way to handle this and the way to make sure that the votes are counted is have enough of a time lag when the ballots are sent, and then giving enough of a time lag after the election to have them counted. And so, again, this is not anything that we have to make up. There's five states that do this for all of their elections, everything by mail. And those are the mechanisms that they use to make sure we don't have that crush that we had in April. And the reason that April was such a mess here in Wisconsin was this was an unprecedented level of request for absentee ballots for an April election because of the COVID crisis. We had, you know, 1.55 million ballots were cast in the April primary, and 62% of them were absentee ballots cast by mail. Another 12.5% were the absentee early votes cast at the clerk's offices. And so that's, you know, we had 1.3 million absentee ballots that were sent and about 1.15 million that were returned. So there's a lot of you know, much more than we normally would have in an April election. And that was one reason I think both the clerk's offices were just swamped by all of this extra volume, and then the post office as well. And so the way to make sure this doesn't happen again is to give enough of a time cushion on either side to both send the ballots and to then have them received by the clerk's offices.
Thanks for the call. We've got a Paul with us now in Toma. Paul, hi.
Hi. I have a question about people who are against using the mail-in ballot. If they were to push that down, I would suggest that the modification of local balloting places where they put up shields and hand-washing stations and social distancing or voting from your car, that those should be eliminated because obviously there's no concern.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, it's an interesting point because I don't think Wisconsin's about to go mail-in only anytime soon. Can you talk about that side of things, making polling places safer and other changes we might need there, David?
Well, right. So that is definitely, I think, it's a good point. We're not going to go to all mail in Wisconsin anytime soon. No one's talking about that for this fall. We simply could not implement something that big of a change in how we vote in such a short amount of time. And so what we'll see is some kind of, you know, mixed version of what we've had in recent elections. But, you know, I think we absolutely will continue, especially if we have a second wave of the pandemic in the fall, the way that some people are anticipating, we will have to have those kind of precautions at the polling places. Now, another thing that other states have made good use of that we could also increase pretty easily would be drop-off sites. So this would address both Paul's point and Bill's point about not wanting to rely on the Postal Service. Well, states that have the all-mail voting, one thing they have are drop sites all around the city, you know, where you can go drop off your ballot yourself in the secure site. So you don't have to rely on the post office. And, you know, upwards of a third of the people take advantage of those drop off sites. And so that'd be another thing we could do to both reduce the pressure on the polling places themselves, which we will have to, again, probably have the social distancing and all of the other precautions that we took, you know, at polling places in April. But if you have those drop off sites, that also take some of the pressure off the post office then.
Thanks for that call. 30 seconds for this answer. David, there's concern from both parties. Hey, if we make this change, is it going to help us or hurt us? With mail-in voting, is there any evidence that it helps or hurts one party or the other?
Well, No, there really isn't. That's the other thing that's really hard to understand, why this has become such a partisan issue. In fact, there was just a study released yesterday by Pew about the early voting that's happening in Georgia right now. They've had 1.5 million ballots requested so far for that June primary coming up. 33% of the requests are from Republicans, 21% from Democrats, and 11% of independents have requested ballots so far. So there, the absentee balloting is really helping Republicans. But overall, studies have shown that there's really not much of a partisan advantage. And so it is hard to understand why this has become such a partisan issue, because, you know, in general, this just helps people vote from both parties.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He's also editor-in-chief of the Election Law Journal and is affiliated with the Elections Research Center. We talked to him today about how voting at home systems work in other states and whether Wisconsin might follow suit in some measure. The State Elections Commission says it could meet next week to hold a final vote for elections this year. As more business opens up in Wisconsin, health officials are concerned about the spread of coronavirus. They're urging people to take precautions when out in public. That includes wearing face masks. Shemaine Mills reports.
Healthcare workers wear face masks because they know they're around sick people. Outside the hospital, it's not always clear who might be ill and spreading germs. People are most contagious with the new coronavirus before they show symptoms. So there's a push to get everyone to cover their face when out in public. But there have been mixed messages on whether to wear a mask. Initially, people were told not to. Out of concern, they would use N95 respirators and surgical masks desperately needed for healthcare workers. Instead, some people started covering their face with cloth masks while shopping, running, and even during sidewalk sing-alongs.
Okay, you are my sunshine.
What's your key? You are my sunshine. You are my sunshine, like that.
You never know, dear.
This group of neighbors on Madison's Near West Side were inspired by Italians who sang from their balconies while coronavirus raged across the country. The singers in the Dudge and Monroe neighborhood give each other a wide berth in the street, and for extra measure, everyone wears a face mask. That includes 72-year-old Wilton Sanders. He says he's terrified of the virus and wipes down surfaces inside his home daily. When he goes out with his wife, Sue, their faces are covered.
Distancing is really what we do. The mask is more a statement that, you know, I'm looking out for you, so I'd appreciate it if you'd look out for me. But, you know, it's only a third of the people who have masks on.
Public health officials across the country are trying to change that because face coverings can block droplets from coughing, sneezing, and talking. But not everyone can wear a mask, and not everyone wants to. For those who have difficulty breathing, a mask makes it harder. They're not particularly comfortable, not to mention they change a person's appearance.
A lot of times we want to have our makeup on, our lipstick, and what have you, and sometimes a face mask may not be stylish.
That's Wanda Montgomery, Village of Brown Deer president. She wears a mask in public and wants others to. In some situations, people have no choice. Menards and Costco now require both employees and customers to wear them. Smaller businesses are too. Rachel Murray is reopening her nail salon in Rock County following the end of a local Safer at Home order. She says she'll be wearing a mask, and so will her customers, although some reluctantly.
I did have one client who was like, do I really have to wear a face mask? And I was like, yeah, you kind of really need to. I'm like, I wear one to protect you. You wear one to protect me.
But she knows customers can't see her smile beneath her mask, and conversation will be different with clients she considers friends. So the state's chummy ways may have to change, at least for the time being. On March 12th, when Governor Evers declared a public health emergency because of the pandemic, he had this to say.
We love to hug. We like to kiss. We love to be friendly. You know, that's why they call us what they call us about Wisconsin Nice. Wisconsin Nice is going to have a different look to it in the future.
Rachel Murray has decided it's worth it to get the message across in other ways because lives and her livelihood are potentially on the line. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll find out how Muslims here in Wisconsin are marking a major holiday at a time when it's hard to get people together in person. Event venues, big and small, were a big and growing business, and they've taken a big hit in the time of COVID-19. We'll check out the challenges facing those businesses, what it can take for them to reopen, and we'll ask when you will be ready to go back. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. It's going to be fun. We're going to get some great holiday weekend grilling advice from Meathead. And you can call in with your questions and advice. And you can get things started right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or on Twitter at Central Time WPR. What is your number one key grilling piece of advice, your magical secret, your technique or ingredient for meat or non-meat alike? That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, it's time for a weekly call-in for kids and parents with a special guest, R.L. Stine, author of the Goosebumps series. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at the relatively high support Governor Evers is getting not only from state Democrats, but independents and some Republicans as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.